Welcome to Money Talks. My name is Mike Campbell. I am glad you're here. Man, oh man, what a week. What fundamental things are changing in our economy, with our monetary system, with the banking system. The list goes on, and we're the right place to be because I've got James Thorne. James was warning us about the very thing we've seen in the U.S. banks about 2 years ago. I've also got Joseph Schachter. He's had a big, not a change, but he had some markers. He has not been in the oil market for months. And he said, but if it hits this, and part of it was getting under $70 into $65, he would be a buyer. You got to hear what he's got to say now if you're interested in that market. And I certainly am. So many other things to cover. I mean, whether we're talking a Goofy Award, man, oh man, I wish somebody would just put in a policy that puts Canada first, not the best interest of a political party. Anyways, I'll get into that more. Of course, I've got Ozzy with me. Victor's got a lot to share here this week. Michael Levy talking about, hey, I know the problems in the U.S. banking system, and they can filter into Canada in certain ways, but we're going to talk specifically why Canadian depositors are safer and some other things, especially the move in gold. There's no shortage of things to talk about, but first, you're going to have to forgive me today for starting with a little bit of I told you so, but I'm doing it to encourage you to start asking the right questions and looking in the right places in order to protect your financial future, which, whether you appreciate it or not, is under attack. As I've been writing and broadcasting since mid, 2019, even earlier, there's going to be a huge number of people are going to be roadkill in an environment of manipulated interest rates, sovereign debt escalation, credit markets under extreme stress, increasing taxation, declining purchasing power of papal currencies. I mean, all of that is going to contribute. I mean, polls already tell us that over half of the population is under significant financial stress, and there is more to come. We warned on dozens of occasions, for example, in 2020 and 21, hey, lock in your mortgage and borrowing rates, because debt was going to be the overriding issue. And obviously it is. But in the process, I'd hear from people totally focused on politics, the petty politics of the day. I suspect that those people don't appreciate that ultimately, finance, economics, the credit markets, they eat politics for breakfast and are going to learn some hard lessons. I mean, we're getting that right now with great examples in Germany. Come on, the green ideology has proven to be no match for the financial and economic reality of the energy crisis. And what do we got? We got Germany forced to abandon its green energy agenda and import record amounts of coal. That's just one example. There are many. Look at the massive political and social change being driven right now in many developing nations over high food and energy prices. It doesn't matter who's in power or their ideology. The economic and financial reality is driving change, just like it is with the pension problems in France right now. Now, I'm not suggesting you ignore politics or pay no attention to the latest scandal. I'm simply saying that it's important to understand that ultimately, economics and politics is far more important to your standard of living. Now, I appreciate we're inundated with political coverage, so it's difficult to appreciate it ultimately actually doesn't matter who's in power when you got to pay interest on sovereign debts, or you got to pay the pensions, or bonds have crashed in value. I mean, the list is a long one. The purchasing power of your paper currency is declining. And let me add one more thing. Politicians who don't seem to understand that, who don't understand that, are arguably the biggest danger to your standard of living. Are you not sure? Come on, it's already evident to about half of Canadians who are under severe financial stress due to rising cost of living. That's a direct result of government policy. And maybe you're not impacted yet, but just wait, you may be. Just a quick question, though, to illustrate the point. Let's look at the employees at Silicon Valley Bank. They've all lost their jobs, or the shareholders who lost all of their investment. Do you think they're happy that the bank paid more attention to woke causes like Black Lives Matter or ESG than proper risk management of their operations? Well, I doubt it. Hey, think about this. Bloomberg reports 915 funds registered under European Union regulations as either promoting ESG or declaring it as their objective had exposure to Silicon Valley Bank. I'm not debating the merits of those causes, but I am saying they are secondary to finance and credit issues. That's reality. Virtue signaling and outright BS come at a cost. On Money Talks, we've clearly stated that 2022 would see the beginning of a monetary crisis, and it would escalate in 2023. We clearly stated on numerous occasions that while 2022 was chaotic, hey, this year would be worse. I still think that's the case. We got a taste last week with the failure of Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, Silvergate Capital, and the bailout of several other banks, including First Republic, and maybe more noteworthy, Credit Suisse in the last few days. This isn't the end. There's more to come. Rising interest rates have created massive losses in the bond market for any pension, mutual fund, bank who didn't hedge the interest rate risk. I mean, it's easy to understand. I mean, who wants a $1,000 bond that yields 1%? We can get 4% in the open market. That's the dynamic we've been witnessing. Because the answer is nobody wants it. So the seller has to drop the price several hundreds of dollars to attract a buyer. And even then, they may not get one. That's what happened at Silicon Valley Bank. When they need money, they found that their bond reserves were worth far less than when they bought them. It happened in the UK, though, with their pensions last September. The value of the bond portfolio dropped dramatically, so they're forced to sell, but there were no buyers. Even at a deep discount, that forced the Bank of England to jump in with about $60 billion worth of buying for their bonds. At the time, I said, hey, this ain't the last time, it's the beginning. I'm going to repeat the phrase that we are all going to become familiar with, the most frightening two words in the investment world, in the financial world, and one awash in debt, and that is no bid. I can go on and on, hey, don't I always? But I'll try to contain myself and simply say, we have to understand the risks to our financial well-being. You can't afford to follow the lead of our politicians, the public school establishment, environmental groups, unions, political reporters and commentariat, and others who don't think about monetary policy and the impact of fiscal policy for that matter. You have to protect yourself from the fallout that's just starting to happen. In a nutshell, I personally suspect that the response of government and central banks to virtually all problems is going to be to continue to create money, further devalue the purchasing power of your currency. And over time, that's going to be reflected in commodity prices, a theme that we've been presenting since February 2020, Outlook Conference. We called it the coming commodity boom. I'm not talking trading, by the way. I'm talking a longer-term approach to protect your purchasing power and ultimately your standard of living. And by the way, I'm going to be continuing along this, asking James Thorne about this in just a moment, asking Joseph Schachter, who's just given the green light on oil. So there's so much more to come. When everything hit just about, what is it, 7-8 days ago, well, Silicon Valley Bank, and then all the repercussions that I outlined a little bit earlier in the show, I had myself thinking immediately about who warned me about this, and it was a big Money Talks theme, and it was James Thorne, Wellington Altus Private Wealth. So I thought, I'm going to give Jim a call and see if, I know what he thinks about this, but maybe give us some heads up about what he sees coming. Jim, first of all, I know you've had a very busy week. Thank you for taking time with us here. As I say, you've been talking about this for 2 years, no big surprise, but give us, I know this is the Barbara Walters, give me the quick nutshell on what finally went down here.
Well, people finally realized that they weren't getting interest on their checkings and savings account. They're getting zero interest, right? And they decided to pull their money from banks. And banking is a confidence business. And so, banks had to sell securities that on their balance sheet were deemed to be held to maturity. They had to sell U.S. bonds that were not trading at 100 cents on the dollar. And once they sold those bonds, their capital requirements were no longer met, and they had to raise capital. And then people realized that only $250,000 of their deposits was guaranteed, and we just had a good old-fashioned bank run. That it's nothing more. This is banking 101, and it was all caused by the Federal Reserve raising interest rates from the zero bound to, let's say, 4.5%. in 8 to 9 months, and all predicated on the belief that inflation was caused by the private sector and unemployment. So it's a huge unforced error by the central banks. And I think people are starting to wake up and smell the coffee.
And as you say, you know, everyone found out that their bank, their bond portfolio wasn't worth that much or anywhere close even, and not anywhere close to what they thought it was. So not adequate there. And as you say, people pulled their money out and went to a money market fund. I've been looking at some of those numbers. They were huge. But let's talk about now, of course, the government's come in and said, you know, through our federal depository insurance, we're going to guarantee all these accounts, you know, over 250,000. We're going past that guarantee. We're basically guaranteeing a system. It's $19 trillion, though, for gosh sakes, you know, if we really held them to their word. I mean, what's going to happen now? I just think the ripple effects are going in all sorts of directions.
Yeah. So let's be clear, right? The banks didn't raise interest rates on checking accounts and savings accounts because it would have hurt their margins and it would have hurt their share price, right?
Yeah.
So regional banks have to either raise the interest rate on checking or savings account. That's one. Or the Federal Reserve has to cut interest rates. It's really simple. I mean, you go on to, and I know you post on Twitter a lot and so do I, and you go listen to these people. And this is really basic common sense, right? What is going to motivate somebody from taking money out of a bank? Well, pay them an interest rate that's basically comparable to a money market fund, right? I mean, this is, and or the Fed, right? The Fed cut interest rates so that, you know, those instruments that are providing interest rates that are based off of the overnight rate. So think about this. A bank can take money and park it at the Fed risk-free overnight and make 4.5%, right? Why can't the public do the same thing? Mm-hmm. This is not rocket science. This is not rocket science. So I think what's happening, Michael, is I want to calm folks down and to sit there and say, if there's a person that understands the plumbing and how this goes down, it's Jay Powell. Jay Powell was Undersecretary to the Treasury in the late 1990s. Jay Powell worked with Warren Buffett on the Solomon Brothers fiasco. He was around for long-term capital management, that crisis. And so when you start to see some of the remedies that are being put in place, like, for example, banks getting together and providing deposits or money for deposits for a bank. That's exactly what happened in 1998 in the long-term capital management, right? The industry bailed itself out. So, we've got programs in place to ring fence the regional banks, right? So the way I look at this, you're right. It could spread into a contagion. I don't think it's going to spread into the contagion. I think Powell has done, I completely disagree with his rate hike strategy, but I do think he understands what's happening and he's doing what needs to be done. Having said that, once we calm everything down, I want you to go back to 08, right? This is the shot across the bow, right? The Fed needs to stop raising rates, stop contracting its balance sheet, and pause, and if not cut. And that is what the credit markets are saying. So right now, the battle has been won short term, but the war, the winner of the war is yet to be seen. I would put it that way.
I don't want to belabor the point, but what has surprised me is it seems that officials were surprised. You know what I mean? As you say, this is one of those issues that is really straightforward common sense. You know, I've got my money in a checking account or savings account that pays me 0.5%. And I can just move it into a money market or something like that and really have a significant increase. It's like they were surprised they did it. And then they were surprised that their value of their sort of backing portfolio, the reserve portfolio, in some cases, others were risk, you know, they use credit swaps to protect themselves. But in some cases, like Silicon Valley Bank, well, they didn't. And it's like, wow. it's not worth as much. It just seems so fundamental. It's not a tough one to understand.
It's not. Some of these banks were not stress test, but even if they were, the stress test that you go through never stress the banks on a rapid increase in short-term interest rates. Mm. So the question you have to ask, and this is why, you know, everybody's writing, you know, War and Peace and showing how smart they are, when it really comes back to what the heck were they thinking about raising rates rapidly when they thought that unemployment caused inflation? That yes. Full stop. And then you have Fed governors in as late as October, Mr. Waller coming out saying, I am not concerned about financial instability. What's he talking about? Right? This is a massive fun unforced error. But let's be clear here, and I want to give credit. You know, at least Tiff Macklin and the Bank of Canada paused, right? And so the next, and so I think, I honestly think that the Fed's going to do the same thing. The real question now comes is how rapidly do they cut interest rates? And the credit market in Canada, so the overnight rate in Canada is 4.5%, okay? So the old adage is you don't need the Fed. All you need to do is look at what the 2-year is saying, okay? What is a yield on the 2-year? And the 2-year is roughly fluctuates between 3.5% and 3.75%. So the credit market right now is saying to the Bank of Canada, you can cut rates to 3.5% right now if you want to. Full stop. And then you shift and you look at the 10-year, the rate interest rate on the 10-year. And what does that tell us? It tells us that long term, the overnight rate of the Bank of Canada should be somewhere between 2.5% to 2.75%. So that's your roadmap. I would suggest to you that's where we're going. And it's how fast we get there really is predicated on how fast inflation drops. And what this does is this allows Jay Powell and Tiff Macklin an off-ramp to move away from the incorrect ideology, which is called by the Phillips curve, right? This is what they hang that unemployment, right? That the private sector caused inflation, which it didn't. It was exogenous shocks. It was COVID and war. Right. Interest rates do not accelerate the adjustment process. This is economics 101. So we would suggest that given the ring fencing, right, the market is actually working as it should. But Michael, here's where I stop. This is like 2008 in February and March. Right. This is early days. Right. If they do not pivot, if they do not pause, Bank of Canada's already, if they don't start cutting rates, if this spreads to the commercial real estate market, right, it's a big deal. Like, and what do we do, right? And this is, I guess, we're talking to Canadians. Don't assume that this crisis that is isolated right now in the United States can't come onto our shores. Don't assume that. That's what the ECB did and Jean-Claude Trichet did in Europe. He raised rates and Christine Lagarde just raised rates, just like her predecessor did. Do we all forget about the banking crisis and credit crisis that happened in Europe and the austerity that happened? So this is very, very early days. I like what Mr. Powell's done. I am thankful for all of us that Tiff Macklin paused, but we are still early and we need to get ourselves out of it. And they've got to get away from this policy and this belief that unemployment causes inflation. It doesn't.
Yeah. Within what you're saying there, there's a couple of things, as you say, pivotal. What the reaction will be, you know, March 22nd, the next bank meeting, you know, in the U.S., will they go a quarter? Will they pause? Whatever it is. I mean, and your point's so well taken. We've got to wait and see. We're early days. I worry, though, that they're sitting there going, I don't want to lose my credibility fighting inflation. And the U.S. inflation's improved, but it's not there yet. And I'm just worried about their psychology. Because, you know, I'm still one of the statements that Powell made back in the fall that had such an impact on me. He says, look, we can't handle it. If something breaks, we can handle it. If it doesn't and inflation runs away, we can't handle that. If expectations of inflation. So I think your point about there's still lots of stuff to see, and that is their reaction past their initial reaction of guaranteeing the deposits. What does this suggest to you for investors, though? I mean, it's a very uncertain environment. Would you just say, hey, go out and lock in some, at least partially, do maybe a step out, lock in some 2-year, some 5-year, 10-year bonds as some, you know, as a significant part of your portfolio, or still too early to even say that?
No, we have been advocating that you need to buy bonds, right? And in this type of an environment, you know, everybody wants to get nuanced and this and that. And all I just say is buy bonds, right? Yeah, if you don't want to buy the 2-year, buy the 3-year, buy the whatever you buy, buy bonds, right? Mm-hmm. We're at the peak in the cycle. Banking crises, Michael, are deflationary, full stop. You have you talk to some very smart people that are better at history than I am. I would suggest to you that if you go back and over the centuries, and I just wrote a piece about this, right? The risk is deflation. Mm-hmm. Banking crises are deflation. Why would you raise rates to slow credit creation down when banks are already slowing credit creation down because of the banking crisis? It makes no sense. So I would sit there, and I've been advocating for a period of time of bonds. And then what I would do is I think, you know, we're going to go back to a period of slow growth. So I really think you got to put your hat on if you believe that we're going to be okay. Then, you know, it's go back to the old themes that we talked about, right? Go back to the old themes. Look at it's technology. Right. Look at I don't know where your callers are on this, but look at how Bitcoin is performing during this period of time. Right. All the long term themes that we talked about before are still there. And if you feel as though that they're going to be OK, we're going to be OK, then I would use this. You know, Warren Buffett would say when everybody's fearful, you want to be greedy. And when everybody's greedy, you want to be fearful. I think you need to step back and make a decision with yourself. What is my strategy going to be? What do I need to see to either go all cash and all bonds? Or do I start looking at some of these very high quality, these companies that are well managed, where the baby is being thrown out with the bathwater? I think you've got to build yourself a strategy right now that's comfortable with what your view is and what your risk profile is. That's the number one thing. And that's what I just keep saying as I'm on the phone continually. You can completely and totally disagree with me, right? And that's fine. I think we're going to be okay. But if you don't, and that's a fair point, right? Then go to cash. Go fully into bonds. Right. Just make sure that what your belief structure is manifested accurately in your investment portfolio. That's my advice to everybody.
And that terrific to hear. But I want to come back to one thing you said, just to emphasize it. As you said, look for well-managed companies. We're not back in that era where it didn't matter. You know, I mean, and clearly there's a lot of people buying stocks that a lot, there was more, there was wings, there were prayers, and there was more, you know, dice rolling. But your point is just make sure you're hearing what James Thorne is saying, and that is it's well-managed companies.
You know, hey, Mike, Michael, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
How many times have you seen this?
Oh, okay. Come 87.
On. How many times?
Yeah. I'm starting in 87 for me, you know. And that's why I've got all the white hair. But yeah, starting in 87, I've been through that. As everyone remembers, or most do, 2009, 2010, 2008, and that whole period there, and several others. I mean, I remember the savings and loan crisis in the U.S. Resolution Trust was another one. You know, yeah, you just start mouthing them off, and in the end, again, what works and what Warren Buffett would tell us what works is quality.
And this is where long-term investors have an advantage, right? So in the early 1980s, it was Continental Illinois. They blew up. What was the event? The Fed was raising rates too much. It was Volcker. Mm-hmm. And what happened was South America blew up. Yeah. And continental Illinois had a bunch, and we had that crisis, right? And he paused. Paul Volcker paused, right?
Yeah.
And then started cutting. So the point I want to make is, I am not saying this is not scary. I am not saying that you shouldn't be fearful. I am not saying, and I want to be emphatic, I am not trying to let the Bank of Canada or the Fed off the hook because of my belief, I am an economist. I have a PhD, classically trained economist. I, you know, am emphatic that what they did was a misdiagnosis, and they did it, and they made a massive policy mistake. Having said all of that, there is a workout. It is possible. I have all the confidence in the world that if there is a person in the world that understands the plumbing and can work Washington and work, you know, Jay Powell is not Ben Bernanke, an academic. So I am my whole view, and I've been on the record saying this, I think this offers Jay Powell the off ramp to ignore the ideologues. And there are significant high profile economists that have walked him into this and walked us into this. Ignore them and work our way out of it. And then what you should expect, a period of, you know, we're going back to secular stagnation and deflation. And in that environment, what works? But I want to give you one last thing I want to say to you, right? Think about this, right? Don't be fearful about commodities. You should be thinking about commodities right now. You should be taking this, if you don't have commodities and you accept my point of view, right? And you don't have, but accept my point of view. Here's your shot to buy high quality commodity companies, oil, right? Nat gas, right? Copper, lithium, right? Gold, you name it. If we go the way that we think that we are still in a structural bull market to at least the early part of the next decade, then here's your opportunity, right? Yes, I love tech, right? Netflix, NVIDIA, AMD, you know, you name it, right? High quality names. But there's high quality areas and sectors that you should also think about when we get to the other side of this. Your thesis about commodities is still prevalent, right? Mm-hmm. It's not going away, right? That's a long-term theme that is not going to go away.
Look, I can invite people. You go to Wellington Altus Private Wealth, and you go just click on the principals, James Thorne, chief market strategist, but you get to read his latest stuff there. That's important. That's my point in bringing that up. Jim, look, I know you were busy this week. You found time for us as usual. Much appreciated. Great stuff.
Thanks, and be safe, everybody.
Time now for the quote of the week. Well, as I hope you know, sovereign debt, individual debt, by the way, underfunded pension liabilities, especially when I look at the U.S. state and municipal levels, but we've got unfunded escalating entitlement payments. We've got massive losses in bond holdings by institutions who didn't hedge the interest rate risk, even some who did, like Credit Suisse. Stubborn inflation, which could force central banks to increase borrowing rates again, despite the other problems. I mean, that's the rock in the hard place. And it's all a consequence or a byproduct of government policy, which brings me to the quote of the week by the Wall Street Journal's Holman W. Jenkins. In quotes, 20 years ago, a presidential candidate could succeed while talking about the unsustainability of entitlements. Now the subject's verboten. Congress enacted a debt ceiling, so it would have to stop, think, and debate before digging the hole any deeper. Well, now the hole's so deep, many in Congress don't want to talk about it for fear of triggering a financial panic. Or take the disputed problem of climate change. The debate now is owned by two lies, exaggerating the problem and pretending green handouts are going to fix it. I'm going to bring Mike Levy in here. Of course, the whole financial world and many more were focused on what happened with the Silicon Valley Bank, with Signature Bank, with Silvergate Capital and really sent a chill through the system, which is, of course, why the federal government acted the way they did in the U.S. The Federal Depository Insurance Corporation jumps in and says, hey, we're not just going to guarantee up to the 250,000 mark. It's just about everybody everywhere. Obviously, they were dealing with a tremendous lack of confidence. But Mike, you know what that begged for me or for many people is, they hadn't really thought about Canada. They don't think about banks failing until, you know, something like this happens. Then they go, hey, is my money safe? And I just think, you know, we have to appreciate that big difference between Canada and the U.S.
You know, for all the decades we've been talking, one soapbox that I've gotten on just about every time it was relevant is we have the safest banking system in the world, in my opinion. I've got to always add that because there has to be that caveat. But Mike, I've been saying it. I've been saying it for years or for decades. You know, as you said, the U.S. Federal Deposit Insurance, they would guarantee to $250,000, but 5 minutes later, because there was repercussions, oh, but we're going to bail out every single depositor, corporate and personal. In Canada, we have $100,000 CDIC per account. Let me tell you, if a Canadian bank, which it won't, had trouble, we in Canada would bail out exactly the same way. No depositor is going to get hurt in either country.
Look, I want to back up for a sec. Let's talk also the size difference is incredible. And we know, of course, their economy is bigger, their financial systems are bigger. But when you look at the number of financial institutions that they're actually saying in the U.S. are going to be protected compared to Canada. Of course, we have depository insurance here, but our market is so much smaller. It's just all I'm saying is this is just interesting, the size of what the Biden administration just promised to protect depositors on.
And Mike, listen to this. In the United States, they have 4,236 FDIC-insured commercial banking institutions, 4,236 banks, and those banks have 72,166 branches. All right, let's go north a little bit. Canada, we have, there are more than 80 banks, but only 35 domestic banks. We call them SCED 1 banks in the country. And of course, there's the big six, BMO, CIBC, RBC, Bank of Nova Scotia, TD, National Bank, and also Canadian Western Bank and Laurentian Bank and several others. But that's it. So really, Canada, still my opinion, is by and large the safest place. And the Canadian banks are amongst the most best capitalized in the world. But you're comparing apples and oranges when you're comparing sizes of banks, the amount of money that has to be guaranteed, and the kind of institutions they are.
Well, let me give that again. I mentioned that earlier, but $19 trillion are in deposits in the U.S. Our depositor insurance is covering $1 trillion. But let me just go to that. I want to just have everybody calm down or rest assured. You know, we talk about $100,000 for the Canadian Depositor Insurance Corporation. Yeah, it's $100,000. But if I've got $100,000 in 9 different financial institutions, I'm protected in all of them up to $100,000. If I have a joint account, that's also protected, despite if I have a personal account too. So that's $200,000 easy. Now I put them in 5 different institutions. We're going up there. But again, I really want to make sure people understand their RSP is also covered. Their registered retirement income fund is covered. Their registered educational savings plan is covered. Their TSFAs are covered. And again, separately covered. So it's not like an accumulated $100,000. They're separately covered each to $100,000.
And Mike, I just want to point out when people say government is bailing out. No, they're not. The banks pay fees for this insurance. And believe me, the fees that they pay for these insurance policies are going to go up very significantly. Same thing in Canada. The government is going to backstop it, but they will get your money back. The money back that people in the country pay out in the way of taxes or whatever, that those fees are going to be paid for the banks from the banks. My point is, it's going to cost you more to bank because of all these failures, because you and I as customers of the bank, are going to eventually end up paying for that.
Well, certainly that's going to be the case in the States. We'll see, remains to be seen in Canada, but you know, that's what they're saying. That's why Joe Biden says, hey, taxpayers aren't on the hook for this. You know, it's the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So every bank, whether you have pristine practices or horrendous management, everybody's paying in more fees for customers, et cetera. Let me just get one more I didn't want to skip over though, Mike, is that if you've got your money in an investment brokerage firm, for example, in Canada, you're also covered. It's just different. It's called the Canadian Investor Protection Fund, up to $1 million. So I just want to allay any fears people have. They've got significant coverage. And again, if I had my money in two separate brokerage accounts, I'm up to $1 million in each one. So there's lots of money being protected here.
There is, Mike, but you know, takes me back to a topic that you and I've been talking about for many years, even a couple of decades, is the purpose of having gold in your portfolio. And I think this was just the example of why you want a little gold in your portfolio. It continues to be the flight to safety and store of value. And when a crisis hits, the world again turns to gold. And those that hold gold in their portfolio experience gold doing exactly what it's done for decades and for centuries. And I was talking to Rob at Border Gold. He says, exceptionally busy this past week. Clients either initiating positions in physical gold or adding to existing positions. It's interesting. Gold in 7 days went up over US $100 an ounce, and it hit US 1920 midweek this week. In Canada, it hit 2,640, a historical high, the highest price ever. But the point I'm making is people are backstopping. They are putting in this place of something of value, some insurance, Mike, that they can protect themselves. I don't think that we are going to have a scenario in our financial institutions where you're going to have to do that in Canada and the U.S., but it doesn't hurt to be a little bit careful.
Oh, the place I disagree with you is the U.S. I think that Jamie Dimon said this week they've got more problems to come. You had Larry Fink saying the same kind of thing. The U.S. is a different system. I agree with you in Canada. But that then, I've got to go one more. You opened up a can of worms for me here. And one good. More is, you know, the old Alan Greenspan line, I can guarantee you you'll have all the money you want. I just won't guarantee what it'll buy you. I still think that's also, and gold protects you about your declining purchasing power, as do other assets too. But that's a big picture that you and I'll get a chance to talk about over the next 20 years. Just kidding, we'll both be dead. We don't have to worry about it. But on that cheery note, Mike, go out and have a great week.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to go out and have indigestion at lunch. Thanks very much.
Okay, Mike. There's so much happening in the markets, as, of course, everybody observing it knows. One of the things, though, I watched how oil has dropped below $70. I thought immediately of Joseph Schachter, who said that's what one of the things he's got, he's a superior researcher, so he's got a whole list of things he looks for as trigger points, but he said he was looking for that. That's the easier one for me to recognize. And I thought, hey, Joseph Schachter must be licking his lips at this point. Schachter Energy Resources, Energy Research. Joseph, first of all, thanks for taking the time. I know it's been a busy time for you because I'm sure there's somewhere in that room at Schachter Energy Research, somebody yelled Eureka. Tell us what you think of the market now, because that was one of the things you told me to pay attention to.
Yeah, the fundamental reason was that I was saying that the $80, $90 price couldn't stay up was because the demand was falling, especially in the United States. And the data that came out this past week on the EIA Wednesday data is that the demand in the United States was 19.1 million, down from 20.8 million the year before, or down by 8.7%. So the biggest economy in the world, the high prices meant people couldn't afford to buy as much, and we had the decline there. The market was at $80 when we were at the World Outlook Conference, and I said at the time we were going to break 70, bottom in the 65-70 range. The market was optimistic the China reopening was going to happen and that it would be significant and we'd have a 1 or 2 million barrel increase in demand fairly quickly. That has not happened. So between the U.S. having negative numbers comparison and China not showing the big growth that everybody thought, I thought we would go down to where companies would say, I'm not going to spend money because I can't make money at this price. And that was sub $70. So we have stocks that are down 50, 60% from where we were at the World Outlook Conference. And there's tremendous bargains that are out there now. And of course, the banking crisis just elevated the story where people are now saying recession. Today, we have problems with Credit Suisse where people are not wanting to deal with them. The stock is down 10% today. The price of oil is, 67, down a buck and a half today. And I think the bottom is, we had 65 at the opening on Wednesday. And so we had four triggers that we were going to use for recommending stocks. And we were sitting only with eight names on our recommended list versus covering the 37 companies. And so the first one was breaking of the S&P has a measure called the bullish percentage index. It was trading at 78 mid-January. And a week ago, it was at 42%. It was 7.8% on Monday. So it busted the 10%. It dropped very quickly in one day because of how quickly oil dropped. And so that was triggered one. And we sent out seven recommendations that day to our clients. Then on Wednesday, we had the big bust, of course, with Credit Suisse. And that all of a sudden people said, this is a world problem. And the price of crude went down over $5 from over 70 down to 65, 55 or 65 low. And that was the second trigger. So we sent out another seven names. We have two more triggers. One, and this one has worked historically, when the bullish S&P bullish percentage index goes below 5%, it's been a table pounding buying opportunity. I think with the problems that we have now and that potentially, more is going to come out, more shoes will drop in the next week or two. I think the Dow goes below 30,000. I think we see the TSX Energy Index go below 200. And right now it's about 212, down from 245 a week ago Monday. That's how quickly it's fallen. And I think we're going to see table pounding buys. We're getting values that we haven't seen in a long time. For people who are conservative investors who are, buying Enbridge or Pembina Pipeline, we've got these companies now yielding 7%. And so because the stocks have come down so much, you can get 15, 20% potential capital gains over the next year. Plus you have a dividend that could be growing by 2-3% a year. So you're getting 7%. So with the capital gain in that, in conservative stocks like that, you can get 20 to 30% over the next 12 months. So we added four of those pipeline infrastructure stocks on Wednesday.
Joseph, that's interesting when you get that. As I say, I love the way you break that down, conservative, but as you said, and you've been reporting, the fallout in other sector, not the, in the broad sector of energy, but some stocks are down like 50, 60%.
So just to give you examples of how cheap things are, we had a great attendance from the energy sector at the World Outlook Financial Conference. So I'm going to take two examples from that. One of them a natural gas story and one of them an oil, light oil company. The natural gas company is Birchcliff Energy. Birchcliff Energy was an $11.88 stock last year. Now we're talking about a stock that's trading at $7.87. And the key thing for the company is it has a net asset value of $25. It has 35 years of gas reserves. So it's a potential takeover when the LNG business takeover happens. Just to remember, the companies that are in the LNG business need to have reserves for the contracts to make the long contracts that they're trying to do. So we've had an acquisition mania in the area. CNQ bought Pain Pony and Storm. Vermilion bought La Crota. Whitecap did the biggest one of them all, XTO. They bought that from Exxon and Imperial Oil for $1.9 billion. So these stocks like Birchcliff are bargains and they have a great reserves in the Montney. The thing is they pay 20 cents a quarter in dividends, so 80 cents. And in their results that they reported for the year, the company has a balance sheet where at the end of 21, they had a $501 million of debt. The end of the year, 132, they're going to be debt-free in Q2. So here's a company that can pay you 80 cents, a 10% yield, and potentially has $25 of value in reserves that over the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years will come up. And the company, because they have no debt coming up at some point, they could even raise that dividend or pay special dividends or do stock buybacks. So we see the stock having an upside in terms of $15. And so if you can buy it at $7.85, 80 cent dividend yield, plus an upside to 15 when we get into more normal markets. I think by the end of this year, we're going to be in the $80, $90 per WTI range. And I think in 2024, we'll be above 90. And in terms of natural gas, this is just because we have a big inventory. We've had a warmer than normal winter, but the industry is slowing its drilling. And the key problem is in 2024, you've got to be filling that Coastal gas pipeline to get the gas to the LNG Canada facility. And that's really the key. So the price of natural gas will pick up $5, $6 in MCF. So we think this is one of the best buying opportunities we've seen. If you remember in March of 2020 and March 13th, we sent out a massive list of buy recommendations. It was a bottom. Interesting, March comes up again, March of 2009, when we had the massacre of the financial crisis and the market bottomed in 2009. So you get these 2-3 week windows up to 2 months where the index is below 10% bullishness, and you get down to like 0 to 1% in like we did in 2009 and like we did in 2020. So we think that's a great buy. So Birchcliff is one of the names. The other one is a Stallworth who's been supportive and coming to the World Outlook Conference for years, and that is Doug Bartoli and InPlay, and of course before that Vero. The stock had a high of 498 last year. It's trading around $2.42, so it's down over 50% from the high of last year. The company only has $29 million of debt, and the equity is $431 million, so there's $3.14 a book. And the company, just to give you an example how cheap it is, they did $1.51 in cash flow in last year, so it's trading at 1.5 times cash flow, and they did 35 cents in the fourth quarter. Just annualize that, compare it to the stock price, it's nuts. And the company has a net asset value in excess of $5. So there's, and all of these companies are trading below their PDP. In the case of InPlay, they have 25 years of 2P reserve. So two examples that have come to the conference, waved the flag, bargain basement stories, and all of these are great buys. And we see, and we're going to probably add a lot more names, including some of the ones, you know, that we'll be talking about in the coming week.
You know, and again, I just want to emphasize that what's changed is the price of these stocks. Like the company hasn't changed, you know, I mean, they're still doing, you know, even with the oil price drop, they're, you know, really viable, especially in Canada. You know, they've got the dividend, they got the protection. But so, you know, what's, as you say, you've got a lot of measures, and I'm not trying to oversimplify how you decide. But one of the key that we all understand is they're on sale. You know, I know that sounds so simplistic, but, you know, things get overvalued, things get undervalued. You have your measures of what that is. And I just want to get the context here. Is that decline? That's why all of a sudden you go, hey, wait a second on these things. It's something that people, if they're interested in the energy side, and obviously on this show, I'm very interested in the longer term energy plays, then yeah, the stock drop is really what we're trying to take advantage of.
Yeah. And the people have to realize that the liquids price, we get, you know, the Americans may get $65 and not be happy with it, but we get 1.36 times that number because of the Canadian dollar. And that gives a massive amount of profitability, even in the mid 60s, just because of where the Canadian dollar is. And if we see, you know, the price of oil go to $90 or $100 in the next 2-3 years, and the Canadian dollar goes to 80 cents, that's still a very profitable business. And with these companies being debt-free, they have a lot of flexibility to either have a growth wedge if they want in the years ahead, or they can be paying more regular dividends and special dividends, or they can be very active with their NCIBs. So these stocks are ridiculously cheap. You haven't seen me this excited about the sector since March of 2020 when we said table pounding buy, and when it was very hard to get people to say, where's the light at the end of the tunnel? And hopefully mm-hmm. it's not the train. And in this case, we are at the cheapest level, and the balance sheets are the strongest I've seen in my career. And they're generating a lot of free funds flow, even at today's commodity prices.
Just to digress just for a second, you know, one of the things that we've obviously had an energy crisis. We've already obviously had shortages, Europe being the poster child for that, but impacting into the developing nation. I haven't seen any big adjustment on the part of politicians to say, we need to change the formula. We need more. We need more production. In fact, I've seen them fight it. You know, I forget which country, because I'm getting so confused with how many have just had these instant jack up in taxes, you know, which just discourage. I mean, you know, the UK windfall tax comes to mind, but there, I forget, there was somebody in the last couple of days who did the same thing, discouraging production. So I don't see how there's a long-term solution in play at this point for the shortages as demand increases. You know, we're well familiar with India now and China, but other parts of the world.
Yeah, if we're going to have a conversion to more solar power, more electric vehicles, we need copper, we need nickel, we need cobalt, we need lithium. All of that's going to come from Africa, South America, from Asia, and they want a higher standard of living too. So they're going to use more energy. So while we may see the demand for crude oil fall in the OECD countries, we're going to see a much bigger increase in those countries. And that's going to keep the drive the price of oil down. And the key thing is, if we don't invest enough to replace our declines, we just exacerbate that 2 or 3 years from now, instead of maybe prices peaking at $90 or $100 oil, we may see oil prices go in the end of this decade, when we have that push to more EVs and solar, et cetera, over the US 147 a barrel that we saw at the high in 2008. So I'm very, very bullish in the outlier years. I was cautious for the last year, as you know, from the comments I made at the conference. Now I'm in full bull mode. And I think these bargains are may not last more than a few more weeks, and people should be taking advantage of them. And so we're going to be sending out even more action alert buys, I bet, in the next week or two. But we have 22 great ideas on our buy list right now.
You know, I think it was Brazil I was thinking of, who just announced the jack up of the taxes. I sort of scrambling.
Oh, the export, tax.
You know, I mean, it's amazing to see them work against it. But as an investor, you know, you have to decide what portion of your portfolio should be in this area, you know, a growth area, but with dividends, as Joseph says, strong balance sheet. So you have to make that decision. And then, as Joseph says, you know, he's excited about the opportunity during this time period. Joseph, I've got to finish with a little bit of bad news for you, because I've talked to Patty in the back office there who runs things. And I said, you know, because I know that, you know, you've just put out a range of recommendations, just added new stocks. And more to come, you know, as prices adjust and all of this kind of thing. So they can actually go to Money Talks, mikesmoneytalks.ca, and we have a special $100 off. Just, I wanted to just let you know, but I prefer to do it when you're live so you can't have a bad reaction with me. but we do appreciate that, and that's what I invite people to do. Go to mikesmoneytalks.ca. We're talking about Schachter Energy Research. There is a special deal, but it comes at a time, as I say. Then Joseph started with four names, added about seven more, got more to come, you know, in the whole thing, to give you something to think about, to give you, you know, if this is an area, you know, you're interested in, give you something, give you some names, give you the background, give you the top-notch research on them. And so I appreciate that. But Joseph, I really appreciate your time and making yourself available in a busy week for you.
My pleasure. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Schachter Energy Research, as I say, just go to mikesmoneytalks.ca. Time now for the shocking stat of the week. Well, it's straightforward anyways, but it is shocking. In a nutshell, a report from Stats Can released this week states that the number of charitable donations in Canada in 2021, latest numbers, are the lowest since they began collecting the data in 1990. The number of Canadians claiming a charitable tax credit on their 221 tax return declined by 165,330. But the decline's been going on for years. Consider that in 2005, you had just over 5.8 million Canadians making charitable donations that qualified for a tax receipt. But by 2021, that number had dropped by over 800,000 donations. As BlackRock's reporter notes, charities have been blamed the latest decline on the pandemic and the fallout from the We Charity investigations. StatsCan notes that, hey, maybe the decrease is related to the increased use of crowdsourcing platforms and other methods of funding that don't provide a donation or a tax receipt. But the decline is obvious, and it's not just, as I said, over the last few years. Here's an interesting point, though. To counter, charities have applied and appealed for an increase in the basic tax credit for donations. It's currently a maximum of 29%. But that was defeated in 2016 in the Commons. They were trying to raise that credit to as much as 75% from 29%, but it was defeated, as they say. But here's the interesting thing. When they asked Warren Buffett about why he created the Buffett Foundation or contributes now to the Gates Foundation, he said that they spend the money far more effectively than governments. But you know what? Governments disagree. But that's an assumption that is not borne out by evidence contained in a relentless number of Auditor General's reports. I want to get Ozzy Jurek in here right now. Talk about the recent report, the latest numbers for February. Let's have a look at Alberta, have a look at BC, but there's also a bigger picture unfolding here. Ozzy, let's start with just count it down. Give me what you saw in some of these numbers, for example, in British Columbia and Alberta.
Well, overall, the report that the British Columbia Real Estate Association puts out, by the way, it's a great report. Just go to the website, bcrea.ca, and you get all of the numbers for every major town in British Columbia. But overall, prices were down 15%. We went from 1.1 million to 941,000. And the overall sales were down some whopping 47%. The thing I just wanted to point out that, you know, this is a number for all of British Columbia. And if you took out Vancouver, the averages would change. So the thing to do is at all of these events, even all of the real estate boards that put out median prices, benchmark prices, average prices, you can find out everything about your town. Look, Victoria is down 9%. So maybe the province might be down 15%, but Victoria only 9%. Powell River is only down 2%. And Peace River actually went up in average price. So the averages are really, you know, only useful for you if you look at the area that you are interested in.
Yeah, and I would suspect that you could get right into neighborhoods with some of that stuff. You know, as you say, yeah, different neighborhoods, and it's just encouraging people to have a closer look. But I guess it does still tell us trends, you know. I mean, and you don't want to make too much of that trend, as you say, because it's an average. You know, we could go right across the country and look at different trends. But I think the point that we've seen nonstop over the last year, well, it's just about the last year, is this decline in activity, decline in prices, decline in sales. You know, the list is a long one, but that's been very consistent, at least. Some areas or even provinces better, like Alberta, but again, you've got a consistent downtrend. And I think people look at that and say, that's the impact of the interest rate increase.
Yeah, no question. That's actually a great point, a question of trend, because in sort of my courses I teach, first of all, if it's inflation or deflation, or secondly, it's timing, and third, it's the trend in the market. One of the trends that's kind of interesting in Alberta is that it used to be that some 70% of all sales were single family, for instance, in the province. Now it's 57%. So what that means is that we're shifting into condos, which means that actually even Alberta is getting closer with its price increases to where people have less affordability. But if you look at Calgary, it makes a big difference. They're finally now also down in price, some 8%. But the active listings are down 17%. And we talked about it the other day. Everybody's talking new listings. Oh, the new listings are down. And what people don't realize is the new listings are down because last month's listings are still for sale. So the active listing is the number. So well, as Vancouver's condo listings are up 11% and in the Fraser Valley up 30%, Calgary's actually down 17%. So that means bodes actually well for a stronger spring market. But the overall sales also have seen a downturn, and actually Edmonton's average price is down some 16%. But again, the smaller towns, Lethbridge average price is actually up 1%. The Medicine Hat sales are down only marginally. So it is so important that we don't take the numbers overall and saying, oh, this is what a market is, because as a town that's just 100 kilometers away from another town might actually be doing quite well comparatively.
Let's take a step back just for a second, because I think the pricing numbers get confusing, what a benchmark price is. But the other is the average price, because, you know, five houses sell at 5 million and 100 houses sell at 100,000 and you get this average price, I think it's basically meaningless to me unless I'm just simply comparing to other years of or months of average prices. But it's not really definitive in any way for me.
Well, you know, it's of course, I've been using averages prices for 40 years, primarily because they tell me what this month actually happened in terms of the number of sales. Now, first of all, you are so right in terms of the numbers. You take the average price for Vancouver or the average price for British Columbia and all those areas, the average single family condos and townhouses. So that's really not meaningful. If I take the average between Lions Bay and Mission and the average in Vancouver is $1.2 million. But if I'm invest on the west side, it's actually $4 million. And if I'm in West Vancouver, it's $3.3 million. And if I'm in Coquitlam, it's $1.4 million, you know, and in the single family homes. So I like the average prices for used properties because that's usually the largest number of transactions taking place in a month. And that's when the averages aren't really that bad. I mean, new houses usually are 10% on the market. But I mean, you're right. You have to look at the numbers. But that's why I look at the Vancouver board. The statistics are really excellent because they give you what you need. Medium, average, benchmark, take your pick. And they break it down by the number of houses, condos. And so just a little bit of work with you and your realtor, and you'll find that maybe in the area that you want to be, you can really identify and pick up a good deal.
Well, what's going to be interesting is this is the last month where we're comparing to, you know, 2022, where the rates hadn't started to rise. You know, they started to rise March 1st, 2022. And of course, we all know and have chronicled how fast they went up over the next 10, 11 months. But this will be the last time we sort of compare to that pre-interest rate increase environment that, of course, even gained much more momentum as we went from March into April, May, June, July, and et cetera, et cetera. But it's going to be interesting because now the comparison won't be at such a lofty number because last March, things did at least start to slow down.
No question about it. And certainly, let's say by the time we go into May and June, we're actually going to look pretty good because we're comparing this year against last year's lower number. March will still be maybe a bad comparison. The big thing, Mike, is, and I know that you've been talking about it with so many of your fine analysts, the world is on fire. And no matter what asset class you're looking at, it's going to be affected. And I think to some extent, the overhang that we've seen this week on bank failures and whatnot, I've had more calls about, the asset of real estate, you know, how safe is it and mortgage rates. And you know, of course, people have this expectation that I know. And, you know, me, I know exactly what's going to happen. When they say, when is the market going to change? I say, well, it's actually June 8th at 9 a.m. It's
the- Yes. Well, I'll come back to what I said earlier in the year, or actually in the lead editorial today, is that I said sort of all of our themes are coming home to roost at this point. But one of the big ones, I said, the phrase that you're going to learn, whether you understand it or not at this point, is called no bid. And it started with the bonds, of course, with so evident with the pension crisis in the UK last September, October. The Japanese world is all about the no bid. And we sort of got toward that, of course, this past week, or fears that we'd get to a no bid market. And there's going to be a lot more talk about liquidity. In the meantime, Ozzy, I want you to go out and have a terrific week.
Well, thank you, Mike. And I just want to share with you, my wife came to me and she said, I'm quoting George Carlin, and she says, women are crazy. I was feeling pretty good. I thought, women are crazy? My wife said that? Yes, she says, women are crazy, men are stupid, and the main reason women are crazy is that men are stupid.
Yeah, I can see a lot of people nodding their head. Ozzy Jurek, go to ozbuzz.ca, ozbuzz.ca. Oh, it's been one of those weeks. I'm just laughing at that. You know, thinking, I know Victor's schedule, and he starts on Sunday, and he finishes on Sunday morning. No, I'm just kidding. You know, he gets about 20 hours off a week at most, and then he does research. Vic, there's so much to talk about, though, and one of the themes that you've been pushing, too, and it's a Money Talks theme, is, hey, who's surprised by something breaking in this market when you raise rates that fast?
Yeah, we had interest rates near zero for more than a decade. And then suddenly, in the course of less than a year, the Fed pushes them up 5%. And, when interest rates are really low, a lot of money gets poorly invested. That just is understood. And as Jimmy Buffett might say, or not Jimmy Buffett, Warren Buffett might say, you know, when the tide goes out, you find out who's been swimming naked. Well, the tide went out as interest rates went up, and we've had some rock and roll. I mean, some real volatility all across assets. You go back to just 10 days ago when Chairman Powell was testifying in front of the Congress, the market was assuming interest rates were going to be higher for longer. Like just over a week later, we're down 1.5 percentage points on where we expect rates to be come June. I mean, it's been wicked out there in terms of volatility.
You know, and the interest rates, of course, have been driving market or perceptions about it and that kind of thing over the last, you know, since March 1st of last year, at the very least, you know, before that, anticipating it. It's just interesting now, the big debate, March 22nd, they come up again. The market still seems to be a little bit mixed on that. You know, one moment, off the top of my head, it was on Tuesday or Wednesday morning. At one point, you know, the market was saying about a 25% chance of raising a quarter. And then 2 hours later, it was 80% chance. I mean, still a lot of confusion out there.
Yeah, the Federal Reserve has their regularly scheduled meeting set for Tuesday and Wednesday of this week coming up. You're right. After Powell had his testimony in front of Congress, really driving home the point of higher for longer, the market was even pricing in a chance of a 50 basis point rise coming up on Wednesday of next week. That seems to be off the table. I'm not going to pretend I know what's going to happen, but you got to think, on the one hand, right now, the Fed is easing by pushing money into the system. Another thing that is going to, you know, tighten financial conditions is banks are going to be less willing to lend. You know, so we're probably going to have some recessionary pressures as banks say to people, no, we're not going to lend you any money. You know, you got to reduce your payrolls and blah, 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 how all that'll go. So the Fed, I guess, conscious of that, they don't need to increase rates. I mean, the commercial banks are going to take care of the tightening for them, is what I'm saying. It's kind of a toss-up as to what will happen. And then the big picture has been all along, the Fed is determined to get inflation down. They seem to have, let's say, you know, ring-fenced this latest problem. So maybe now they can stay focused on keeping inflation down, which would mean they either increase rates by 25 basis points, as they've been saying they were going to, or they just kind of stand pat and they've got a good excuse for that.
Yeah, I got a couple more things I want to get to here, but one is, it's straightforward, but it's again a theme that we talk about or something we talk about. I was looking at the bond market and I was thinking, how many people who took Powell at his word, you know, as you say, just like 10 days ago, and now have to short cover? You know, hey, maybe rates aren't going quite there, you know, so they've had to scramble back in, which of course pushes prices further.
Well, the bond market has had a scorching rally, okay, since Thursday of last week is when we got the rumors, at least the public started seeing the rumors about Silicon Valley Bank. So bonds are up because interest rates are falling. They're seen as a safer alternative to stocks. There's a prospect of a recession coming. And the market was massively short bonds. And when a market moves the way it has, whether it's the short end or the long end, people that are on the wrong side, they're trying to be buyers too. And it just drives prices crazy. I think the only time in my life I remember seeing bonds rip like this to the upside was in the evening after the stock market crash in October 1987, the bond market jumped 12 full points that night. And I happened to be, just by happenstance, luck, I was long out of the money calls and bonds that went soaring into the money. And it's one of my best trades I ever made.
And you're still living the good life off of that one. No, I'm just kidding. Hey, Vic, before you go, though, I want to come back. I just had a brief chat with Mike Levy about gold, but gold's performance has been very impressive here, if you're on the long side.
Yeah, you know, I think there's been a lot of fear in the market. We've seen cash move into money market funds. Certainly gold has caught a bid. I guess from the lows of last week to where we closed on Friday, we're up about $165 on gold. That's the best price we've seen in 11 months. It's near the all-time highs that were made when the Russians went into Ukraine at the end of February of last year. that's gold. But on the commodity side, I know you're talking with Joseph here about crude. Crude's the WTI anyway, is I think at, where are we at? We hit a 14-year high or something when the Russians went in. Now we are down 50% from where crude was when the Russians invaded Ukraine. And the commodity indices generally are at a 15-month low. Now, commodities have been trending lower before we got this flare-up, but this flare-up of risk kind of has added to the pressure, and I think also looking ahead, maybe a recession, less demand for commodities, whatever. That's just where they are. Instead, for me, instead of trying to figure out, you know, what's going to happen, I look at what the price is, and that's what I trade.
I see it, though, as a big-time example of your time frame. Not yours, but, I mean, everyone has to set. Like, so if you're a five-year kind of trader, you love to see, and you're like a group, you love to see the decline. You know what I mean? Because you're 5 years in it. You're a trader. You've got to look at a lot more stuff, as you say. You have to look at the market price action at the moment, you know, and other indicators like that. But it is a time when, before you assess any of this stuff, decide what your time frame is and your risk tolerance, of course.
You know, one of the things that's just odd that we're seeing in the stock market is that the strongest sector of the stock market is what we would call the super cap tech stocks. In other words, people are buying Microsoft, Apple, Google, Amazon. Now, those stocks are sensitive to interest rates, maybe more than the broad market. I mean, stocks like Caterpillar Tractor or Deere, you know, are getting dumped and people are buying Microsoft. It's almost as though, you know, the super cap tech stocks are now a staple of the economy.
Fascinating stuff. Of course, you'll be busy with it. I say, you know, Saturdays, this is the last bit of work you do on a Saturday. You get a few hours off and then you start again on Sunday. So we really appreciate it. You can go to victoradair.ca. He will be putting up stuff today. victoradair.ca. It'll be ready for you. So go and check it out, victoradair.ca. Vic, have a terrific week.
Thanks, Mike.
Time now for the Goofy Award. After weeks, well, maybe first years of refusing to take action on Chinese spying, cyber attacks, intimidation of Canadian citizens, especially with family in China, industrial theft, and more recently, interference in the federal election by the Communist Party, and infiltration of some political staffs even, the federal government continues to refuse to hold a public inquiry into Chinese election interference, which of course opens them up to a myriad of questions regarding what are they hiding, exacerbated by the fact that the Liberals are doing everything they can to prevent the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Katie Telford, from testifying before the Commons Procedures Committee. Well, maybe it's not hard to see why. Because despite numerous reports that the Prime Minister was briefed as early as 2019 on the Communist Party interference, specifically 3 weeks before the 2019 election, national security officials gave an urgent classified briefing to senior aides from Trudeau's office. It warned that a Liberal candidate was part of a Chinese interference network. And the Prime Minister says he was not told, which means that his chief of staff withheld vital information regarding a national security threat, which is clearly not her decision to make, or she knows the prime minister was aware and did nothing. I mean, there's no win either way. Of course, the Liberal government knows that efforts to prevent her from testifying create even more suspicion, but maybe they think that's the lesser of two evils. But it's the same with demands by all opposition parties, that the majority of the public, they want an independent public inquiry into Chinese election interference, which the Prime Minister has refused to allow. Which brings me to this week's Goofy Award. And by the way, it's not to the Prime Minister or the Liberal Party for their refusal to call an independent public inquiry. And that's despite polls showing a majority of Canadians, just a recent Léger Global TV poll found 72% would like one. Instead, the Prime Minister has called an inquiry led by who the government calls a special rapporteur, former Governor General David Johnson, who the Prime Minister describes as a family friend, a friend of his father. And as Mr. Johnson says, they had adjacent cottages in the Laurentians. Now, no one is debating David Johnson's many accomplishments or his integrity. He's clearly an outstanding individual. The debate is whether a family friend is perceived to be the best choice. They had what's being called an independent look into Chinese election interference, which obviously will emphasize the government's response to Canada's top security agency's warnings. If the goal is, as the Prime Minister himself states, to strengthen confidence in our democracy, then a family friend's not the best choice to lead this inquiry in order to address the concerns of those who are worried about Chinese interference. I mean, it's all about perception. Mr. Johnson has been put in a no-win situation through no fault of his own. Well, he shouldn't have accepted the role, I think. The majority of Canadians want an impartial, independent public inquiry that is seen to be above politics. No matter what he finds, I think it's just too easy for people to attribute David Johnson's political affiliation as a motivating factor. And that defeats the whole purpose of an independent inquiry. Now, if you don't agree, and I appreciate some won't, I say just look at the comments pages after this announcement. And by the way, I would suggest people in the media who support the appointment of David Johnson have a look, because clearly a huge number of Canadians think the choice is partisan. And that defeats the purpose. As regular listeners know, and a few in the commentary either, I think it's just very few, understand or acknowledge, the big picture beyond the petty politics of the moment is that we're living in an age of declining trust in government and the establishment, which is driving massive political and social change. As evidence, you got Brexit, you got the truckers' protests in Canada, more recently that in the Netherlands, the election of Donald Trump, the widespread protests in Europe over COVID restrictions, and now the Ukraine war, and high energy and food prices, especially in emerging markets. I mean, there's so many examples. Yet most, maybe all in politics, are more concerned with their personal power than restoring the foundation of our society, and that's confidence in government and its institutions. Whether we're talking healthcare, whether we're talking about the cost of living escalation or election interference, we need to restore confidence in government. But if restoring confidence was indeed the goal, instead of managing the fallout for the government, then an independent inquiry would have been chosen, and certainly not a close family friend and a Liberal partisan, no matter how outstanding a citizen, and he is, they would have chosen someone who is perceived to be completely independent. That's all the time we have today. Hey, so much going on, but look, I really appreciate you listening. I encourage you to join us on Money Talks tweets or Michael Campbell's Money Talks on Facebook. And of course, go to our website. It's mikesmoneytalks.ca. And in the meantime, I hope you have a terrific week.
This is the Money Talks podcast with Michael Campbell, available at mikesmoneytalks.ca or through your favorite podcast subscription service. Join us on Facebook at Michael Campbell's Money Talks and on Twitter at Money Talks Tweet.